Eddie and his friends were a rough, tough, rollicking bunch of flyers, but real pioneers in the air. They lived hard and furious, but Reed Chambers knew another side of Eddie.
Rick was always religious. He and I lived together practically all the time we were on the front. And every night, Rick would kneel by the side of his bed and put his head in his arms. And while he made no sound, I still am convinced that he was praying. In fact, his religion, for my money, is far better than that of most of the creeds that I know of. If everybody lived like Rick does, it would be a far better world.
Captain Eddie came home to a hero's welcome, big reception, endless speeches. But when these had ended, Eddie embarked on the first phase of his business career.
Maybe folks would argue with me about this, but I think the greatest single contribution he has made to America is the example that he sets. Even today, as a businessman, as a rugged individualist, as a man who likes to try to make things stand on their own feet and pay their own way, and a man who stands for less and less government interference in private industry, as a champion of real economics in industry. That's the kind of a thing he's doing.
But Eddie's first really big business venture was not going to be a success. He wanted to build the great American car. And he and three Detroit automobile men formed the Rickenbacker Motor Company. It was organized in 1922 with $5 million capital. This dream child was unveiled in New York and at first was a big success. The Rickenbacker looked like a sure winner, and it was difficult to keep up with the demand for the car. It had many engineering firsts, including four-wheel brakes. But this innovation proved to be a detriment, at least at that time. The car was criticized, and the brakes were described as dangerous because they brought the car to a stop too suddenly. Finally, this criticism, coupled with the 1925 slump, brought to a close Eddie's dream of a great American car, and it left him with $250,000 debt, which he swore he'd pay off, and he did later. More and more, he turned to the aircraft industry, and while working for General Motors, was connected with the Fokker Aircraft Corporation and Eastern Airlines, then owned by the big corporation. Another company owned by General Motors at that time was Eastern Airlines. Alfred P. Sloan, former president of General Motors and later chairman of the board.
At that time, in 1934, Eddie had charge of what was then the General Motors Eastern Airlines division. Finally, the time was reached when the corporation decided to remain in manufacturing and dispose of its interest in airplane operation. This necessitated the sale of our Eastern Airlines division. Eddie was much interested and extremely anxious to work out something whereby he could take over our interest in airplane operation. I am reminded of how he telephoned me shortly before Christmas in 1938. It so happened that his opportunity to purchase the property expired the next day. While he had promises of financial support, he had nothing tangible to offer. He was, of course, worried and upset, as he naturally would be. He decided to call me at 11 o'clock on a Saturday night and asked if he could come in for a few minutes. Of course, I told him he certainly could. He comments on the fact that on his arrival, he found me in pajamas, a robe, and slippers. He never was able to quite figure out whether he had wakened me, got me out of bed, or how it happened. Anyhow, we had a discussion on the subject. I told him further, I did not know just what the status was, as it was being handled by the financial people in General Motors. But I promised him I would look into the matter immediately And if a commitment had not been made, I would assure him a real opportunity to see what he might do. And further, not to worry about it.
Eddie rounded up $3.5 million in 30 hectic days.
I can't talk from the standpoint of his colorful exploits as an automobile racer or a fire in World War I, because I didn't know him at that time. But I can speak from very definite knowledge of that phase of his life with which I've had the closest contact, namely his business career.
Hugh Nelton of the investment firm of Kuhn Loeb tells why the financial world had confidence in Eddie, even though his Rickenbacker car of the 20s had been a failure.
20 years ago, in the spring of 1938, my firm had an important part in the purchase of Eastern Airlines from General Motors. At that time, this airline was a mere fledgling. It was doing a business, a total business, at a rate under $5 million a year. Eddie Rickenbacker's confidence in the future of this enterprise was terrific. It was unflagging and it was contagious. But even so, it required a real element of faith, because no one had yet demonstrated the ability to make an airline profitable. That Eddie Rickenbacker's talents were equal to this challenge is certainly most dramatically shown by this fact. Eastern Airlines has operated profitably every year since that time. This is an outstanding record in the industry, and today this little acorn, this little acorn of 1938 has grown into a tremendous oak, now operating at an annual rate not of $5 million, as in 1937, but $265 million, a growth of 5,200%, all under the leadership of Eddie Rickenbacker.
This time there was no doubt Eddie had become a successful businessman, a captain of industry. Along the way, he had bought the Indianapolis Speedway at a cost of $700,000. But now, once again, his great love was the airplane and air transportation. Alfred P. Sloan again had a conversation with Eddie, and again Captain Eddie suggested something based on what he had seen in Europe.
He had been in England, through the Middle East and Russia, on confidential missions for the government. On his return, he came in to see me, and we had lunch together and discussed aviation technique from its various angles. At that time, he was enthusiastic about the potentiality of jet turbine power for airplanes, as was being developed in England, Russia, and Germany. He felt that a great corporation like General Motors should be involved in this development, both for the sake of our national security and our general economy looking to the future. He also urged upon me the fact that our government and our military services were far behind the English, Germans, and the Russians in the development of this type of power. How fully subsequent events have proved Eddie's keen foresight. But Eddie's contribution to the advancement of our society has been far broader than his initial interest in the automobile industry and later service as an airplane executive. He has distinguished himself as an American at the highest level of patriotism and service to the welfare of his country, both in war and in peace.
We will return to Biography and Sound, Captain Eddie the Iron Eagle, after a pause for station identification. Captain Eddie was continually on the watch for new developments in the aircraft industry.
From my point of view, he could properly be considered the dean of the air transport industry.
Lawrence Rockefeller, a director of Eastern Airlines and a friend of Eddie's, sums it up this way.
Someone who brought the discipline of business method and accounting, of economy, and far-sighted planning into the industry. He expects to get the cooperation and backing of his associates, and he takes a good deal of convincing to convince him that maybe he is wrong. If he is, naturally he recognizes it. But just vacillating opinions or casual guesses don't make much impression on him. You have to be factual, and you have to have a good deal of steam behind your facts if you're going to change his point of view. He is amazing, though, because he is such a great leader, and yet he does have this kind of, you know, this ability to go down into the organization and listen and get facts. But still, as leader, he makes the decisions.
Yes, Eddie Rickenbacker was now firmly established as the well-publicized president of Eastern Airlines and was in the news again and again. One veteran newspaper man who got to know him well was Jim Kilgallen of International News Service.
My association with him has gone back 35 or 40 years. Let's see. Yeah. I had known him back since the days when he was fooling with cars and was going to be a race driver back there in Indianapolis, where the famous Speedway is. He was always a straight, honest-to-gosh sort of a fellow, down to earth, feet on the ground, not a bit of pretense about him. He's one of these men who makes a million friends but doesn't hesitate to make an enemy. Rickenbacker was in the past often taken a stand on something which was unpopular, and he would draw criticism, but he's the type that never backed up. I don't know whether it's any good to rake it up now, but he didn't believe certain things and said so in speeches, and he would get subjected to a lot of criticism, but he didn't seem to mind it.
Eddie capitalized on his own popularity, making friends for Eastern. He also collected an assortment of enemies. Organized labor was openly against him for his wartime criticism. And labor didn't react in too friendly a fashion when Eddie reminded them that he had been a working stiff too and had been glad to get a dollar a day. He put this criticism behind him and continued to fly Eastern's routes, minutely examining every phase of the operation. On one of these trips, he wound up in South America with Arthur Godfrey.
I think the most amusing incident we had was in Santiago in Chile. We were there just in time to witness a minor revolution. And they brought out the Carabinieri, I think they call it. Carabinieri, the police, who have little short Tommy guns. And by George, they put on a shooting match right there in the city square, right in front of the hotel where we were. And then it died down, and we thought it was over, and we had a dinner date, a high-level dinner we were supposed to go to, right down one of the streets off the square. And we started down that street, Rick and I, and some of the other people who were on the trip with us. And as we walked down this street, a very narrow street with high stone walls on each side, a fusillade of bullets, a hail of them came down that street. And they were going ping, 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 and banging off the walls on either side of us. We turned around and started running. And I thought I was going fast, but here come Rick past me, say, "What's holding you up, boy?" And we, as he said, we went back to our hotel to previously prepared positions at the bar and thought it over.
That trip was exciting but fun. Another trip ended in tragedy. On the afternoon of February 26, 1941, Eddie boarded a plane in New York, bound for Mexico City with stops in Washington and Atlanta. The time came when the plane should have been over Atlanta Airport, ready to start an instrument landing in the fog. The pilots started to set the plane down. A split second later, a wing hit the treetops. The plane hit the ground 10 miles outside the city. Ralph McGill, editor of the Atlanta Constitution, was in the rescue party when it reached the scene of the crash.
As dawn broke, we found ourselves really almost on the wreck. And, of course, seen literally through a drifting curtain of fog, it was an awful sight, as those things always are. So there they lay, the DC-3, One of the most completely wrecked aircraft I've ever seen. The front of the airplane was almost mangled, as if it had been run through some great set of teeth, well past the cockpit and into the first row or two of seats. At any rate, we began to lift up these tangled and broken pieces of wreckage. And up near the front, I would say about a third of the way back in the cabin, or where the cabin normally would be, we found Captain Rickenbacker. We first thought we had found his body. Someone said, leaning down and feeling his pulse, he's dead. What we didn't know at the time was that one of the news agency men set out then, because Captain Rickenbacker was the most notable passenger aboard the plane, he set out and ran through the mud and the thickets about a mile or a little more to a telephone and flashed in the word that Captain Rickenbacker was dead. We were holding the presses in Atlanta, and we started out with an extra of this. Fortunately, the later word got in, and none of the papers got on the street, but the headline did say Rickenbacker dead. At any rate, to go back to the wreck, we finally got him moved out, and then by putting a hand up under his shirt, one could feel a very faint heartbeat. We didn't quite believe it at first.
It was a night of trial for Eddie. His skull was crushed, his left arm broken, his left eye was bloodied, both legs were broken, and his lungs were cut by jagged stubs of ribs. But through it all, Eddie managed to keep the other survivors from destroying themselves.
He could hear some groans. He could hear somebody calling for help every now and then, and people talking, praying, and that sort of thing. And he kept calling to them, "Don't light a match. Don't light a match. Don't use a lighter, a cigarette lighter." Because he knew if any flame should have come, the whole thing would have gone up and everyone would have been burned to death.
Eddie was taken to Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta, where he lay in a coma for many days.
I was there the day that he became conscious for the first time. He had, of course, been under an oxygen tent. And he began to stir around. The nurse notified the doctors, and they came in, and he opened up that one eye and looked around, spoke to people, and he said, "I'm hungry." Well, of course, that delighted everyone. They'd been hoping for that, because the only thing he'd had in the way of food was some intravenous feeding. And so Dr. McRae said, "Well, that's wonderful, Eddie. What would you like?" Captain Rickenbacker reflected, and he said, "Well, I'll tell you, Doctor, I have an appetite right now for a ham sandwich and maybe a bottle of beer."
It was almost 4 months before Eddie got out of the hospital. Then war again. December 7th and the attack on Pearl Harbor. One day, General Hap Arnold, commander of the Army Air Forces, called Eddie and proposed a job. That is, if he felt well enough to do it. Eddie did. He was to make a flying tour to every Air Force combat unit and instill in the men the sense of conquest that is the core of combat psychology. Said General Arnold, "Tell Rick, I want him to put turpentine under their tails. I want to get those youngsters fighting mad." Eddie did just that. Then there was a trip to Russia, and a story told by Eddie to actor Adolf Manju.
"They just got back from Moscow, and he gave me a Russian bill, autographed it as a souvenir, which I added to my short snorter, which everybody had at that time. And he told me a very interesting thing that had happened. The Russians, as is their custom, decided to try to get him drunk. And they were drinking vodka out of water glasses, like water. And Rickenbacker, not to show the white feather, he turned to his aide and said, "You stand behind me and hold me up. Because I'm going to drink glass for glass with these fellas." And when it was over, he said they were on the floor, not me. He was being propped.